XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back a little into hour two, and Alan Foreman is going to join us next. And before we get to Alan, I'll mention the scratch in New York. Andy just sent out the scratches. In addition, Nick mentioning that Wildcat West was coming out, Height actually scratched as well, which doesn't hurt my feelings either, because that was a horse that I was a little iffy on the Grussmark runner. So we got a field of nine in that nightcap, which makes it a little easier. But still, if it's not going to be one of the favorites, good, who knows? Who knows what it's going to be? And we'll watch for the Churchill. We'll watch for the Churchill scratches next as well. I think Kevin Kirstein actually is had the early version, and if I'm not mistaken, and from the Churchill side, the MTOs came out. That helps in race nine, the one and the 1A. The one was an AE, and the 1A was an MTO, and the 12, 13, 14, 15. So basically, you can cross out everybody that was underneath the 11, churn and burn. All the AEs and MTOs came out of the sequence, and those are at least for now, from the early scratches. We'll see if there's anything later before we get off the air. And happy to get a chance to talk to Alan about the very good news yesterday. The Mid-Atlantic offering their latest report as part of the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan, and the plan specifically designed to reduce equine fatalities. Between Alan and Scott Palmer, Dr. Palmer in New York, and they hired Andy Belfiore. Got to see Andy for a minute while we were at Keeneland. And the only way we can measure this really is by, starts per, incidents basically on a per start basis, usually, 1,000 starts. And is Alan, I think Alan is with us. I think I hear a little something in the background. Alan, good morning. Oh, no. Okay. I hear what it is now. Okay. it's the sound of the phone. Let me just reach out and say that Casey's trying to reach you. All right. There we go. I sent him a text. The number, and I'll give you in advance of Alan's joining us, the incidence of fatalities per thousand was at 2.4 between 2010 and 2014. And between 15 and 19, it had dropped to 1.8. And, that middle portion of the second half of the decade, is really the era when this topic, started to really hit home. And, there was overt and pointed efforts, some of it tying back to the aqueduct spate of breakdowns. And then this year, so far in 10 months, down to 1.21. So effectively, from the first half of the decade to the end of the decade, the Mid-Atlantic has cut fatalities in half per thousand starts. Alan Foreman, good morning, and well done.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It really is good news. It's very encouraging. Very encouraging statistics. And we know the plan's been working, but, you know, these results are kind of an eye-opener, and we've really drilled down to see what's going on, and we you can't knock success. This is tough stuff, and there'll be bumps in the road, but this is really encouraging statistics that we felt we needed to get out to the industry.
There's a part of this, and you and I talked about a month ago, and part of that included the postscript of Santa Anita's successful meet. And one part of this that always, to me, needs to be driven home is it has to be the statistics and the discussion needs to be viewed, on a horizon, meaning a long, wide basis, because there are going to be spikes, and they're the potential, because you're dealing with external forces that can be potentially managed but not controlled, meaning the weather and the conditions that are associated with the effects of the weather on turf courses and on main tracks. So if you do what you've done here in terms of the statistics and you show a 10-year moving average, it's slow and a steady decline to cut basically in half. But within that period from 2010 to 2020, invariably there were spikes, and it has to be viewed on a long-term basis. You can't take a snapshot and say, well, this is where we are right now. That's never true.
It's a constant battle, and that's why I said that the success they had at Santa Anita this year is terrific. They've implemented some significant strategies, and it's working, but that doesn't guarantee that going forward they're not going to have spikes. So you have to be careful, what you do with the information that you get. What we've learned in the Mid-Atlantic is that you have to keep to your task, and we do. We have every stakeholder. The horsemen are invested, the racetracks are invested, the regulators are invested, the veterinarians are invested, and we have everybody at the table on a daily basis, implementing strategies that we have that we've put together that we think will bring the overall number down and benefit the health, safety, and welfare of our horses. And one of the really positive things is that if we start to see a trend, we can grab onto it very quickly and attempt to introduce strategies that will stem that increase, whatever it is. This is not a perfect situation, and there are going to be circumstances that were not foreseen that can influence your numbers. For example, they had a spike at Saratoga this year. New York has had a remarkable – New York's fatality rate has dropped approximately 40% since the task force report, and they are consistently – at a lower level than they've ever experienced. But they had a spike at Saratoga this year, and when you drill down, it was two-year-olds. And the question came up yesterday, well, has COVID had any effect on it? And Dr. Palmer, who studies this on a daily basis, believes that the phenomenon with respect to two-year-old breakdowns at Saratoga this year was directly related to the COVID situation, because these horses train differently. The load factor was different. Saratoga is kind of the Super Bowl for two-year-olds. A lot of the trainers, a lot of the owners want their two-year-olds racing at Saratoga, and their training routines may have been interrupted by the shutdown that we had for a period of time related to COVID. And they grabbed onto it fairly quickly, and it stopped. But those are the kinds of things that you can't anticipate. But when you look at the overall strategies that we've implemented that are, you know, whether it's medication, whether it's layoff reports, whether it's pre-race examinations, the work of equine medical directors, the commitment of horsemen, the elimination of certain medications, they all have had a contributing factor to this. And where there were dramatic decreases in West Virginia and in Delaware, at Finger Lakes. I mean, you know, we have a wide diversity of racetracks in this region. And when you see the impact that it's had on some of the smaller tracks that had higher numbers previously, you know, you get a sense that what you're doing is working. And, you know, perhaps there's something, not perhaps, I think there is something to be learned by the industry overall through the work that we're doing, which is why we shared this information yesterday.
Fold in some of the, you know, some of the specifics and some of the things you think that that clearly affected change and impacted the results, because there's probably gaps that were filled in by certain initiatives that for whatever reason. It might have been areas that hadn't been addressed fully, or you know, with, you know, with real focus in certain jurisdictions. Anything on that front that you can identify? You know, including whether it's medication, you know, tightening of medication rules, or supervisory, you know, kinds of things. The vets you know, doing more, you know, pre-race exams, whatever it might be?
Well, we've talked to some of the equine medical directors to see what their perception has been this year in particular. The Mid-Atlantic's done a really tremendous amount of work, and there are a lot of initiatives that were implemented over in 2019 and 2020. But I know a number of them feel that the withdrawal of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs within 48 hours of a race, the anti-stacking rules, and the 14-day intra-articular joint injection rule have made a significant difference. They see it in their pre-race examinations that horses seem to be more fit, and the examinations reveal a stronger and more fit horse that is going to the starting gate, and they think that has had a significant impact. We, you know, this exercise is about identifying risk factors that cause you to eliminate horses that may be at risk going to the starting gate. So we instituted a 150-day layoff report requirement. If a horse has been laid off for 150 days, it's a red flag. If the horse has been laid off for injury for that period of time, that horse is at a higher risk. There are horses that get breaks throughout the year, and maybe a horse just coming back from a break is not one that we should be as concerned about. But the fact of the matter is those horses are all being flagged. They're all being looked at. I think that's had a significant impact at Finger Lakes. We believe it had a significant impact at Penn National. So we know that's working. We have void claim rules throughout the region now, so that, you know, horsemen who are putting a horse into a claiming race that may have some kind of an injury in the hope they lose the horse, we've clamped down on that, and so perhaps lesser unfit horses are going to the starting gate in claiming races. We're analyzing every fatality to determine what the cause may have been. We instituted almost a total ban on the use of thyroid supplements. You know, we had a high incidence in 2019, and we've seen it in previous years, of sudden cardiac arrest, sudden deaths in horses. They go into these statistics. And anecdotally and otherwise, and just our own surveys in the backstretch, led us to believe that there was a widespread overuse of thyroid supplementation. It's been eliminated. We can see the difference. The elimination of bisphosphonates. We don't know the extent to which that may have had an impact in Mid-Atlantic racing, but they've been eliminated here. Transfer of joint injection records. All those things add up, and our medication, our medication rules, our pre-race examinations, they all add up, and you can't point to one thing, but you know that your overall strategies are working. The last thing I would say is that we developed what's called a gap analysis when we put this plan together. It was essentially through the region and through working with experts, we developed a 30-plus checklist of things that we need everybody to do. And you use that as your report card. You use that as your measurement each year to see, is everybody complying with it? Who isn't complying with it? It lets you self-report yourself. It lets you look at where you are in relation to others, and it has a certain peer pressure about it. And when we looked at the gap analysis that we developed just from a blind sheet, what we did in 2019 to 2020, it's really remarkable to see how jurisdictions are all coming into compliance with the various requirements that we have on the gap analysis. So it really points to a real team effort. I mean, a terrific team effort. Everyone in the region helping to make this happen. And I think it sets a standard for the rest of the industry. And if we go into federal legislation or whatever, we think these are the standards, and we think this is the paradigm that we're certainly going to encourage the authority, if it's ever created, to follow for the industry.
And when it comes to compliance or monitoring and I know you brought on Andy Belfiore last year, and how much of it, of these kinds of initiatives, how many of them can be encouraged or coerced even with the jurisdictions that don't necessarily have the rules in place, depending on, the state by state, operation, the way, the way the various state commissions administer the game in their, respective state. I know that the NTRA has worked on that front when it comes to the, Integrity and Safety Alliance, a set of protocols. Talk to how this, this message and, these kinds of efforts get initiated and executed on a wider basis.
Sure. So you have to remember, whether it's the Mid-Atlantic, whether it's NTRA, whether it's the Riverfront Safety Coalition, whether it's JAI, whoever it is, whatever the jurisdictions and the stakeholders agree to do is voluntary. There's no hammer. There's no stick. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking at federal legislation to have a hammer, so to speak, for those jurisdictions that are don't go along with these reforms, that don't think that they need to do them or don't want to spend the money to do so or otherwise. That's the challenge that you face. One of the things that I think has motivated the success in the Mid-Atlantic region is since the day we've been doing this. I mean, I've been facilitating these meetings for 25 years, and it started at a small table with just regulators. And then after the crisis in New York, we broadened it to the entire region, and everybody has bought in and invested in this. We're very clear, if this is not your cup of soup, then, go to another restaurant. But they're all at the table, and that doesn't mean that everything we've done, has been perfect. For example, and we called them out yesterday, West Virginia has not adopted the restrictions on non-steroidals and joint injections. Nonetheless, they had a great they had a significant reduction in fatalities, but they're not doing what everybody else agreed to do. So the region calls them out, and we'll work with them to get them in compliance. Andy Belfiore has been a marvelous addition, not only because this is within her wheelhouse. She loves doing this. She's totally committed to aftercare. She's totally committed to the health and welfare of the horse. And Andy is, she does this, she works this full time. She is a consultant to the THA for this project. And she works everyone in the region. She forms committees. She works with the committees. She drafts protocols that we work with. I mean, she really coordinates everything that we're doing, and you need that. You have to have somebody there who's doing it. And the other thing is that I the Mid-Atlantic is a wide diversity, has a wide diversity of horsemen, tracks, regulatory bodies, and they are, you know, from the largest, the NARA, which is the behemoth, to the very small tracks, whether it's, and that's not to, to be the least bit derogatory, whether it's, you know, Finger Lakes or Colonial or otherwise. And you have to take into consideration when you do this the nuances of racing, the quality of horses, the availability of personnel, the economics. It all has to be factored in when you come up with these standards, because you want everybody to be able to buy into it and be able to do it. You don't want to make it so onerous that they simply can't do it. And so I think that has played into the success as we've developed protocols. You know, I just look around and I see how the equine medical directors work together. I see the interaction between them. I see the communication between Andy and the various stakeholders. And, you know, we've got committees working right now. We're already working on next year. So we're going to be implementing a regional continuing education program for trainers. That's going to help in trainers identifying horses at risk and other educational initiatives. We're working on jockey health and trying to help, you know, the jockey health situation and try to regionalize and maybe nationalize that. We've done some significant things. We've got a lot of things that we're working on, and it never stops. You just have to keep at it. You got to make sure what you're doing is working, and you got to keep an eye on what's going on, and then you start to implement more strategies that make it better. The void claim rules, we've got greater buy-in. Dr. Tim Parkin, who's the international expert, says he's seen a 27% decrease in fatalities with the adoption of void and voidable claim rules. So the little things that all add up to a larger picture, and that's, I think, the message from yesterday is, hey, look what happens when you implement common sense strategies to, you know, make our racetrack safer for our equine athletes.
Alan, I mean, how I have made the point repeatedly that it's a dangerous scenario to try to merchandise or market safety results and statistics, because, you know, it very easily can go south in for the same reasons I brought up earlier. I mean, there's, you know, there's forces, but how do you and how do we as an industry, how do we tell this story, number one, without, you know, trying to look like we're patting ourselves on the back, because, you know, this by all rights, it has always been job one. It doesn't mean that every one of these I's were dotted and T's were crossed. There was just a different, there was kind of a different ambient, I won't even say philosophy, it just, the conditions were different. And you know, all you have to do, you can look at the food chain industry and how you know, they've, whether it's the free range poultry concept, whether it's the humane slaughter and processing concept. I mean, the obviously the societal pressures and you know, external forces, you know, changed the atmosphere. How do we, you know, how do we say that, you know, the scrutiny, we're always willing to accept the scrutiny, but, you know, how do we properly merchandise, you know, these kinds of successes?
Well, look, the narrative has been difficult. It's been difficult to penetrate through the noise of those who want to paint the industry as being insensitive to the health and welfare of our horses, or that we're not doing enough to curb doping or whatever, or, you know, whatever. That's been a narrative for a number of years, and that's been tied to the political issue of whether or not somebody else should come in and oversee the way we run our business. And you know, that has a that's a two-edged sword. In some respects, it may help you politically to get something done. At the same time, you may be creating marketing and other image problems for an industry that you know needs some good news. It's interesting when I was on a Zoom call with, and Dr. Parkin was on the call, and he says, do you all understand how rare a breakdown is of a racehorse in the context of the thousands and thousands of races that are conducted every year? He said it's a very rare event, but in this country, it certainly has become very magnified. And of course, we have situations where we have clusters, and those are the ones that really hurt us. But you know, we're doing better, doing much better. We're not in the marketing business. I don't have the money to hire public relations firms, and the Mid-Atlantic doesn't have the money. We're not going to put the money into hiring public relations firms to get into a public relations exercise. You know, we would hope, and we said this to the media yesterday in our call, you're the ones who are putting the information out, not only to the industry, but to the public. And so we're bringing this information to you in the hopes that you will help to get the message out and put this information in context. We will be transparent with you. It may not always be a feel-good story, and we're certainly going to tell you where we see weaknesses or if we've fallen down, but we deserve to have the good information told. And, you can look at the media today and see how they've covered it, how seriously they take it. I think that most of them walked away yesterday with a feeling that, hey, this is progress. You know, it's not victory, it's progress. I keep looking at the prospect of federal legislation because I think it's going to happen. And I think it does set up a mechanism for us through the authority to perhaps, if we have a good story to tell, to use that mechanism to tell the good story, because the authority is the one who's going to be speaking to the public. It's going to be speaking to the public at large. It's going to be addressing the animal rights groups and others in a way that we simply can't, because we're so tribal in this business that anyone who dares get up and speak is looked at, you know, with certain colored glasses, you know, whether it's me or whether it's the Jockey Club or whether it's, you know, whoever it is. Tracks, you know, everybody's going to be looked at in a different light based upon what, you know, their perceived leaning is, so to speak.
Similarly, when it comes to some externals, I know that that the crop discussion came up yesterday. What's your read on this? I mean, I got my own sort of.
When we get the Mid-Atlantic together, we have all of the stakeholders at the table. So we don't have to limit ourselves if we don't want to just medication, safety, and welfare. I mean, I told the press yesterday that, you know, one of the first things we did over 25 years ago was develop the uniform licensing program so that we had one license that everyone could use throughout the region. That is now the National License Compact. So we have the ability, when we get everybody together, to start looking at other things. We're looking at Sal Sinatra's presentation on changing the claiming game and going to the possibility of rating races. That is an extraordinarily complicated topic. We've already formed a committee. Andy Belfiore's, Sal, are working with. We've actually set up two committees. We're going to look at its feasibility. But with the crop rule, given that this industry has been consumed with the debate about the crop rule, and then, you know, obviously the Stronach Group, Belinda Stronach, recommended elimination of the riding crop in among the reforms that were announced in California last year, there's been a very vigorous industry discussion and debate about it. And so we decided back in the in February, it started with the THA, we brought it to the Mid-Atlantic, maybe it might be a good idea to try to see if we could develop a uniform crop rule for the Mid-Atlantic, because, again, you've got this concentration of racing and racetracks that you don't have anywhere else in the country, with riders who are moving from state to state. And, you know, why don't we take a look at the issue and see if we can't come up with a model rule? Well, at that time, New Jersey was looking at eliminating the crop. New York was part of the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition. Maryland had implemented a new crop rule of 10 strikes. And, you know, it was kind of chaos in the region. And so we decided, brought it to the Mid-Atlantic at our meeting in March, and they unanimously agreed that they wanted to address the crop issue. And so we appointed a committee to deal with it, worked intensively over a period of 4 months, worked with the Jockeys Guild, and our starting point was the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition's rule, which we said is too long. Let's tighten it up. Let's hit the main points, and let's come up with a regional policy rule, however you want to call it. And we also looked at a new penalty system patterned after the multiple medication penalty system that has been so successful in the Mid-Atlantic with medication, that if we're going to have a new crop rule, we've got to figure out a way to make sure it's enforceable. And so, make a long story short, and through changes that were made, either at the request of the Guild or because we saw what California's rule was or Kentucky's rule, we came up with a six-strike, no more than two strikes in succession without giving the horse a chance to respond for the Mid-Atlantic. And we said that the rider could use the crop underhanded until the final use the crop underhanded up until the final quarter mile of the race. Now, in Kentucky, it was, you know, the first eighth of a mile, so we had our differences. But we all agreed to that rule. Maryland implemented the rule. Delaware implemented the rule. And Pennsylvania has implemented the rule with what they think is tremendous success. Very few complaints. Rider compliance. Better riding. Less use of the crop. Horses on a straighter path. And they've been very happy with it. New York is looking at that right now. New York is looking at a number of different recommendations, and we hope that New York will follow the Mid-Atlantic model. And you can see now in New Jersey went with its no-crop rule that the Guild has decided to challenge legally. And we're hoping that New Jersey will take another look. And, we'll follow the Mid-Atlantic rule. And then as we do it, the industry can see, is this the right way to go? Should this be modified? Should there be more strikes? Should there be less? But we think that the Mid-Atlantic can be the kind of the laboratory for a uniform rule. And the way it's playing out so far, it's been a success.
Yeah, it's a nonstop, 24/7, attentive, everybody, pulling in the same direction. There's really no let up, Alan. There's no, saying, okay, the job's done. That's one message that gets driven home.
It's so true, so true. But it's nice to know that, Scott Palmer, Scott's an amazing guy, and I think he's probably the best in the industry at doing this kind of thing. And so we have a great team. And Scott has said that, you're going to hopefully see incremental change. These are not things that happen overnight. You have to stay at task, and you have to do science and evidence-based work. You have to base it on evidence. You can't base it on supposition or anecdotal information or otherwise. You got to really drill down. And there are going to be times when it's not going to go your way, and you need to get on. But we know we can get on it. We know we can fix it, and you have to be very upfront about it. And that clearly is the attitude in the region. The support at every level when we sit down and talk about these things and we propose new initiatives and new changes, and we find out why we can't do something or what it's going to take to get something done, we try to figure it out. And that's what I think, as an industry as a whole, hopefully we'll be doing going forward.
Now, and the opportunity to just maintain and do everything, everything possible. Everybody benefits. I'm not going to have a chance to do it right now, but, this past weekend, Alan, there was one topic that came up that nobody would have anticipated. This is that case regarding the eight yearlings that were bought at the October sale, that this complete, just a heinous concept. Guy taking, you know, taking eight yearlings just purchased and taking them to Mount Airy to sell there and potentially, you know, profit selling them by the pound. I mean, just the whole concept of it, I had to read it three times to believe what I was reading. And, you know, here's something that you just, that wouldn't, I mean, there's things that just, that seem to come up that you just couldn't, you couldn't anticipate. And it's so many, there's so many different areas like this, you know, where we're confronted and then immediately accused of our, you know, of our haphazard and our unfeeling approach. And it's like, who even would think of something like this? That you have to now, you know, come up with safeguards in a whole new area.
Well, for those who are proponents of the federal legislation and they think, well, why is the Federal Trade Commission involved? And some of us have been critical that the legislation doesn't give the authority jurisdiction over breeding practices or things that may happen until a horse becomes a covered horse. But the proponents correctly point out that there are unfair, deceptive trade practices and other practices that would give to the Federal Trade Commission and to the federal government jurisdiction and authority. So, you know, to the extent that things may come along that are abusive and cannot be tolerated by our industry, there may be a mechanism going forward to address that. So. Okay. You know, there are pros and cons, and, you know, you put that hammer over people, they may think twice before they do it. So a lot to think about. Look, you know, we're going to – who saw COVID coming? You know, some people can say, well, your statistics are so much better because of COVID. You had a shutdown of racing for 6 weeks. Yeah, but the analysis that we do is based on number of starts, and it's all relative. So COVID has nothing to do with it. COVID is not a factor. COVID may have been a factor in the spike of two-year-old fatalities at Saratoga, because there is an explanation for that. It's a plausible explanation. So, you know, you get curveballs thrown at you just like it. San Anita last year, you know, I think everyone is convinced that weather was a significant factor. And we're always dealing with weather as a factor in the Mid-Atlantic because we have such a changing weather conditions. We're a temperate climate. You know, we're not a static climate throughout the year. And so we get these swings. And swings can affect what we're doing. And we've got a group in the Mid-Atlantic that's looking at that so that we can, you know, we can improve on dealing with weather phenomena. If we start to see a spike and it's related to the weather, we grab onto. And so that's the good thing about the process is what they're doing in California. And I you know, the industry, I would hope, would get its act together on this, look at what we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic, look at it as a model. If we're not doing something we should be doing or we could make it better, you know, come on, join with us and help us to do it. This is all for the benefit of the industry. This is not some individual success story here. We're trying to help the industry, and we think because of the configuration of our region that it's a really great proving ground for things that that will work everywhere.
Alan Foreman, THA Racing, if you're following along on Twitter and at their website as well. And, Alan, congratulations and passing along to, you know, all the track managements and everybody that, you know, is involved in a success story like this. And it's a wide, you know, sweeping range from New York to Virginia. So continued success, and I appreciate the update and the visit and the work.
Thanks, Steve. We appreciate you having me on.
Not at all. Alan Foreman, everybody. And the strategic plan to reduce fatalities, absolutely seeing results. And I'm glad Alan mentioned, you know, that the per start statistic, you know, pretty much, you know, squashes the argument that, oh, well, yeah, there was no racing for April and May. It's immaterial because it's based on, you know, on the number of head that entered the gate. Steve Askin entering the gate and anxious to hear. I haven't seen or heard a single response from Steve yet about the way he enjoyed Breeders' Cup and what his thoughts were. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Oh, excellent. The week has flown by, and we're still, you know, still digesting and watching replays and looking back at charts and prices, looking at it from every angle. What is the Haskin angle in recapping Breeders' Cup?
Well, as an, you know, as an overview, I mean, there were several races that I liked a lot. You know, some disappointments, which are typical of Breeders' Cup. But I guess if you're referring to the Classic, well, you know, to be honest, you know, since the race and my follow-up column, I haven't given it a lot of thought, and probably won't. Now that Authentic is retired, which was totally expected, but for a race with so much promise, I thought it was a disappointment. Not because of who won. I feel the best horse won, and I think Authentic has proven himself to be a top-class horse, but because of how it was won and how little the other horses did and how they were ridden and what we were expecting. You know, as much as I love American Pharoah, I thought his Classic was a bore, you know, for a championship race. And this race was, in its own way, very similar. It was different because we didn't have a horse as dominating as Pharoah, and we were expecting a competitive race, and we got just the opposite, you know, over a souped-up track that saw an absurd four-track records broken, which I don't know if I've ever seen that before. But the, you know, I mean, the sad part of all this, and I know it sounds like a broken record, but you know, once again, we'll never know how good this horse is. I mean, he has shown more improvement and more maturity in the last 3 or 4 months than any horse in memory. And I remember in the winter and spring and early summer, he was a one-dimensional speed horse who needed to have the lead. And the one time he didn't get it early in the Sandy Derby, he folded. And in the Haskell, he tried his best to give it away over a track which he probably should have blown his opposition away. But from the Derby on, you know, he grew and he matured into a professional racehorse and a warrior who proved he can get in a fight and not back down. And he's still a horse who wants and probably needs the lead and somehow always gets it. But, you know, as surprising as his Derby win was when he came again to beat Tis the Law, I thought his Preakness defeat was more impressive, because he was faced with something he had never been faced with before. And I didn't hold it against him in the slightest that he couldn't or wouldn't pass the filly. I've seen it too many times before. I saw Buck Passer unable to get by Priceless Gem in the Futurity. I saw Curlin unable to go by Rags to Riches in the Belmont. I saw a Spectacular Bid have the hardest race of his undefeated year when he struggled to beat Glorious Song in the Amory Haskell. You know, it happens sometimes with colts and fillies, but you know, he kept fighting, and I give him certainly a lot of credit for that. And remember, as I mentioned last week, he got a negative 3.25 Thoroughbred number in the Preakness, which was a huge leap from the Derby, and was the fastest last out figure of any horse in the race. So he really has improved with every race. So, you know, of course, now with his victory in the Classic and maturing into a potential superstar, he's gone. And don't get me wrong, I like Wayne Hughes a lot, and I admire what he's built at Spendthrift Farm, what he's built it into. And, you know, listen, he's got every right to do what he wants with his horse. And I honestly hope this horse does great at stud. But as a racing fan and a historian, I'm sorry that he'll never get a chance to reach his full potential and get in the Hall of Fame, because he won't get in with 8 lifetime starts. So now we have to start all over again looking for the next big Triple Crown horse, probably from the Bob Baffert barn, knowing it's most likely going to end the same way, like Pharaoh and Justify and Authentic. I don't even want to get into the rides that I thought some of the other horses got in the race, you know, especially the speed and pace horses whose jockeys just sat back and let Authentic open up by three lengths, turning into the backstretch. I told Joan, as soon as he went to the backstretch, I said, this race is over. There's no way in the world this horse is going to get caught.
Yep.
I mean, that's it. You know, I'm watching Tis the Law. I said, what's going on here? I mean, I'm watching Maximum Security. All these horses with, you know, Global Campaign. It's like they're all sitting back and watching him saying, don't you know that this horse is not going to come back to you? That this horse has proven in his previous races that when he gets the lead, he's a very, very tough opponent. So go after him. You know, I mean, you see horses like, you know, Thomas the Tahoe, who, for some reason, I mean, is one of the most consistent horses in training, you know, does nothing in the race. And by my standards, you know, these are all tough, older horses who were supposed to beat good three-year-olds. But, you know, once they were down the backstretch, I said, you know, that's it. This is for what was supposed to be competitive race is now over. You know, and you look at all the top class older horses in the race, with the exception of Improbable, none of them showed up. And who knows? Maybe Authentic is just that much better than any of them. I don't know. But they never gave him a chance to prove what he could do under pressure. Because I thought for sure somebody was going to put pressure on him. I thought Maximum Security, like I mentioned last week, and he's got more natural speed, I think. And I thought he was just going to lay right off him. And I'm saying, why is he taken back? I mean, I don't get it. You know, and I could see if he had a half-length lead or three-quarter, but when he opened up three lengths, I said, I just don't get it. But, you know, listen, that's just a classic. You know, I'm not going to, that's only one race. You know, there was some other one, but, you know, Swiss Skydivers stumble at the start. And if you saw a picture of it, I mean, she really tore her foot off. And, you know, I mean, it's a heck of a way for her to go out in such an amazing year. It's a shame, but you know, I'm not going to take anything away from Animoy Girl. I mean, I think it was great seeing her win. It's a great story. We're still going to see her again. We're still going to see her against Swiss Skydiver next year. I just wrote a whole column about, to me, in my mind, how in the last decade, fillies have completely taken over the popularity contest over colts. Cultures come and go. But the fillies, I mean, they're staying around to 5, 6, 7 years old.
Yeah.
You know, Starship Jubilee beats the colts at 7. Now, you see all these fillies running at, yeah. You look at Beholder. Look how long they kept her in training. And now they're going to do the same thing with Monomoy Girl. Now that they have her, she could have very easily been retired. I mean, it would make sense. And for, you know, for whatever reason, they're keeping them in training, and we got a great rivalry, hopefully, to look forward to next year. So that was great. Whitmore was fantastic. I mean, that probably got me more emotional than any of them. Because, I mean, his, you know, a 7-year-old and a rare male who's, you know, gelding a horse. He's a rare male that's still around. And, you know, for his fourth try at the sprint, and plus I had him in the race. I really liked him in the race. I thought it was set up perfectly for him, you know, especially when Vekoma scratched. You know, I don't think there was anything earth-shattering in that race, and I thought he had all the class, and it was just great. And then I was just happy for Bob LaPenta, who wasn't able to come because, you know, he's still high risk because of, you know, he still has not 100% over the Legionnaire's disease. He's only 80-90% over it, so he had to watch from home. But you know, I contacted him after the race, and he was in tears, and he was still very emotional and crying after the race. And I just think that was great.
Nice.
And I was really happy for Gamine, who I think, you know, redeemed her reputation, you know, and showed all the doubters how brilliant she really is. You know, everybody was saying, you know, everybody starts talking, she's juiced and she did this. And yeah, I know she had the two positives, but, you know, they're most, you know, obviously 99% contamination. And it happens. Sometimes, and Baffert even admitted that he's got a, you know, he's got to bear down and watch the stable closely. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to get a little bit sloppy. But certainly her positives did not affect her, those two monster wins she had. And we know now, around one turn, she just looks totally unbeatable. I mean, she's just an absolutely brilliant filly, and I was happy for it. I was happy for her, and I was happy for Jill Baffert, who's absolutely madly in love with this filly. You know, she'd always tell me how kind and wonderful she is to be around, and she absolutely felt so bad for her, and, you know, what they've been going through all year. So I'm just glad that she was able to restore her reputation and show people that she is the fastest and most brilliant horse in the country right now around one turn. I mean, she's just an absolute monster. So, you know, I thought that was great. I was happy for the Europeans. Maybe not to win all four grass races on Saturday, which just made our grass horses look pretty pathetic, especially with Aiden O'Brien finishing 1-2-3 and winning with a 94-1 shot. I mean, that was pretty wild. I would have loved to have seen Magical go out a winner. I mean, she really deserved to. She was running against Cole. She never finishes out of the money. The only time she finished out of the money, I think, on the last 16 or 17 starts, when she was like fifth in the arc a couple of years ago. But I mean, she's raced against Colts in every race. And, you know, in the last, I think she ran against Colts in like 16 straight races and was first, it was in the money in 15 of them. So, yeah, most of them were grade one, group ones. So, you know, I was happy to see her run a big race, you know, which she did. But, you know, it's unfortunate. She, you know, she got beat by a better filly who was a really good filly herself. But I think it was great for the Europeans. A lot of these trainers and jockeys that won, we really didn't know. We got to know them a bit more. And, you know, as far as the 2-year-olds, I think we saw a legitimate Derby horse on Friday. He looked I thought he looked very strong. And Vequist, I absolutely loved. I mean, I only had 2 winners on the Breeders' Cup. She was one of them. I absolutely loved her. I loved her numbers going in. I just watching her race in the Frisette, I said, you know, when they go 2 turns with her pedigree and her running style, I said, she's going to move way up in this race. And so one of the rare occasions I was right. So, you know, I thought, she showed how good she was. And so unfortunately, we were talking about Princess Noor, who went into the race with a 10 thoroughbred figure, which was horrible. And she goes off as the favorite, and, you know, she didn't run well. So that's one instance where the thoroughbred numbers proved to be reliable. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, you know, it was exciting. You know, I wasn't crazy with the way it ended. I would have liked a more competitive race, and obviously even more disappointed, even though totally expected when they retired Authentic. In fact, in my wrap-up column, which was kind of whimsical, actually, because, again, it's based on my almost owning a micro share in the horse, so I had more fun with it. And, you know, I said in the column, I said, look, he's going to be retired, but, you know, I double dog dare Spencer Farm to keep him in training as a 4-year-old, knowing that they wouldn't do it anyway, but I figured just have some fun with it. In fact, I called up Leonard Lusky, you know, secretary.com, and said, look, you got to post this column on Sunday, because by Monday it might not mean anything anymore, because I don't think we're going to go through Monday without him being retired. And sure enough, he was retired on Monday. But right now it's all about the fillies in my mind. I mean, I just, those are the ones that we can embrace. Those are the ones that keep running. And over the last decade, if you look at the most popular horses in the country, to me, the vast majority of them have been females. So I don't know. How did you look at it, and how did you do in betting?
I had a kind of a goofy couple of days. The race that I like you on Friday, Vequist was my really good opinion on Friday, and it actually helped for the 2-day as well, because the 2-day double, Vequist Monomoy Girl was okay, and that was nice. The race that absolutely stopped my day completely was the filly and mare Turf, and I had no issue with Adaria, but I singled Rushing Fall, and I just thought that she was winning.
I tell you one thing, she ran her heart out. I tell you,
she did.
You had to think the same way. I thought at the 16th pole and a 70-yard pole, I thought she was there. I thought she was home. I mean, it just looked like she had, the wire was going to come up and the other filly wasn't going to catch her. And she was digging in. She wasn't coming back to her. And I thought for sure she was going to win it. And I couldn't believe that filly got up in the last jump or two. But she looked like a winner to me, 70 yards out.
Agreed. And it just... I wasn't worried about the distance. I know that, you know, the part of the, you know, the postscript has been, you know, just a scotch, you know, too far for her. I think what really was more impactful was Cayenne Pepper lighting out like that early. And the next thing you knew, both Rushing Fall and Mean Mary were kind of drafted into, you know, chasing and staying, you know, being within striking distance. And to me, I think that may have been the, you know, the element that kind of sapped her in the last couple of jumps. But no, listen, you can't, you got to make, you know, certain stands somewhere. You know, the other retrospect that I've been saying the last couple of days as we go through these, going back and looking at that sprint, Whitmore really did, to some degree, have a career-long class edge, really, on that group. The more you looked at it, you realized, you know, this wasn't... this was kind of a modest bunch. And, you know, I picked Firenze Fire and keyed off of him. And, you know, at 9-1, that was a square number. To me, I couldn't even have, you know, sort of flexed to Whitmore watching the board, even though that price was way too much on him.
Yeah, I thought so I thought with Vekoma out that they would play him more.
Well, the way the racetrack though, the way the racetrack was running, you just felt like, you know, it's going to be somebody that's going to be on or near the lead. And when he came storming, I was with Jenny Reese, and Jenny realized even before I did that it was Whitmore, and she goes, "That's Whitmore," and I was like, "Oh my God, you got to be kidding!"
I told Joe way before the finish. I said, if Whitmore gets out, I said, he's a winner. I mean, you can just see the way he was running. As if he, you know, if he pulls out, if he gets a clear run, he's home. He's got too much class for these horses. You got to look at a horse like Yopan. I mean, Yopan was coming off the Chick Lang, and he was a 3-year-old with 4 starts. I mean, Whitmore just was so tough. And just sometimes these sprint races, it's more about class than it is about speed. You know, we've seen it so many times in our races. In these races. And the thing is, you know, you talk about the track. Listen, normally he ran fast, but you know, compared to that monster in the first race, by the way, he was slow.
Yeah, that's a crazy... I hope he can stay sound.
You know, with 2 starts, I mean, to run that fast, I mean, I don't know what kind of freak that is, or, you know, it's just... I just don't... You know, Keelan's not known... You always thought of Keelan in the past as being the conveyor belt. You know, speed favoring track, and it could get fast. But I've never seen it this fast. I don't know why they have to make it this fast. I was talking to somebody who's, you know, a very noted horsewoman. Works for a noted trainer, veterinarian. She was telling me that on Friday morning, she was out on by the rail. And she said she was listening to the horses go by. She said it sounded like thunder. I mean, she said, I hope that they put some, and that's what she said, first thing that came to mind, she said, I hope they put some cushion back on this track. Because obviously they scraped a lot of it away. I mean, you just can't break 4 track records in one day. It's just, you know, it's just crazy.
I don't know.
All I know is that it's time to start looking at the 2-year-olds now. I got to start looking for the next horse to be retired at the end of next year. I got to start looking for the next Derby horse. I mean, that's we've got some interesting 2-year-olds. Yeah, there were a lot of disappointments in that race too. But you know, she shows you sometimes the horse going 1 turn to 2 turns, they're not quite the same. But I still thought Jackie's Warrior ran a good race, but there was some disappointment. Reinvestment risk, I thought, was a big disappointment. And, I think, you know, you talk about odds, by the way. What about the odds on Fire at Will? What the heck is that all about?
Everybody agrees. That was the price. That was the monster price of the whole thing.
One. Coming off that race, he did in New York. I mean,
yeah.
give me a break. I mean, that race has always proven to be wide open. You know, you're either coming off a win in the Pilgrim, or you're coming off a win in the 2-year-old race at Keeneland or at Woodbine. Or whatever. Most of these horses are coming off of first or seconds in these stakes races. So the one that's coming off a stake in New York, you send off at 30-1? You know, it's not like the race in New York was a fluke. I don't know.
No.
That really just boggled my mind. I wish I had noticed that odds before the race. I would have, you know.
No, I know.
I would have put some money on him right on the spot. I saw it after the fact. I said, oh, boy, I think. What was that all about?
I agree. That one was, when I looked up, that happens a lot at Breeders' Cup, you know, when things are flying around and, you know, then you look up and you say, oh, my God, how about Mother Earth was 23?
I had her. I loved the Woozy, 22-1, I think.
Yeah, 23-1.
I thought she ran, I had her. I really liked her in that race. I mean, there were two Europeans I liked that race, and she was one of them. And I bet her, and I thought she ran a really good race.
There was also right off the bat in the juvenile turf sprint. You Better Believe It was a horse that plenty of, when we were mm-hmm. talking to Euros, got, you know, plenty of attention, and 27-1 finishing third. I mean, a lot of the things that we use as potential approaches, you know, in terms of identifying horses that are going to be running late that at big prices, kind of came to pass. I mean, that obviously Golden Pal at 4-5 was going to depress everything, but
that's
still.
I mean, that's a fast horse. I'll tell you.
Yeah, it still was a three. I mean, with the two logical, with the absolute 1-2 runners, that Bodenheimer, which you know was a nice, you know, another speed horse, the Valerie Lund runner. I'm not sure why Bodenheimer ended up going off as the second choice at 8-1. That surprised me.
There was buzz. There was a lot of buzz. I was hearing a lot of buzz about him before the race.
Interesting.
The way he was training, I think a lot of people really liked the way he was training in the morning. And I heard talk about him.
Interesting.
It didn't shock me.
Interesting.
You know, there's always going to be shocking odds, I think, both ways in the Breeders' Cup. That's why, listen, there's always going to be long shots. You've got to find them. I know people, you know, on Facebook are telling me that they had Order of Australia. I said, well, congratulations. I don't know how, but congratulations. I had the Aiden O'Brien horse that finished third in that race, so I thought ran a good race. But, I mean.
Well, he was Lope Fernandez.
Yeah, the horse we talked about last time. That
exactly.
I liked him a lot in the race. I thought he ran a big race, but I couldn't. Horse gets in off the ultra eligibles and
exactly.
wins 90-1. I mean, wow.
Exactly. That was crazy. Well, the same thing. And the funny thing is, I mean, they've had the same thing happen. Obviously not a cup race, but in the Bryan Station, you know, for George Weaver's horse to draw in he literally was one of those years ago when you would buy the paper, that was literally a horse that was on, you know, the page you don't turn.
Exactly. Yeah. You know how many times me and everybody else get screwed because the also eligible horse was always on another page. And you never ever turned the page, and yep. when the horse won, you said, "Who is that horse?" And you said, look back in the racing form,
and he was on the next page
by himself on the top of the page, the next page.
We should name one the horse from the next page, the next page horse.
Exactly. You know how many those horses win? You don't even know they're in the race. Yeah, you're watching the race, and you say, "Who is that horse? I never heard of him."
You say,
"Oh, not only is he on the other page, but he looks pretty good."
Well, that was certainly the case for him. I mean, for the horse of George's, Ever Dangerous, I went back and I looked. I said, ugh, this horse was completely playable. I mean, I when I'm on the air Friday, it's always hard to, you know, to adjust for that kind of thing. But when it came to Order of Australia, I literally was standing there on the rail in front of the Winner's Circle, and he came up the main, you know, he's on the main track getting ready to cross over because the gate, of course, is right across from the stands, right across from the Winner's Circle, where they're going to start the mile. And he literally came over and stood, and Boudot, he didn't want to cross over that horse. And so Boudot kind of backed him up a little bit, and he let the others cross. And I think when he saw the others cross, then he became more comfortable of going over the bridge to, you know, to get on the turf course. But in the meantime, he was standing there in front of me for a good 90 seconds. And I'm looking at him, and yeah, I knew he had drawn in because Marcus Hirsch was with us when this whole thing came up that you know, he was going to scratch out of the Bryan Station. And I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, but that's a good looking horse. And then I see him, you know, as they're hurtling to the wire, and I started laughing to myself. I said, "Oh my God, this horse is going to win! It's just the craziest thing ever."
They must have thought enough about him because they ran him in big races.
And well,
races, and then he ran, you know, so okay. But you know, his last two races were awful. I mean, they obviously thought enough of him at one point, but. I don't know. Especially when Aiden O'Brien's got that many horses in there. If it was his only horse, then maybe you'd take a stronger look at him and say, well, Aiden O'Brien is sending his horse. It's the only horse he's running in the race. I figure there might be something there. But when he's got three in there,
yeah,
and you like the other two much, much better, you know, and you say, he just somehow accidentally got put into this race. And the thing, you know, Aiden O'Brien... He had all his horses ready because they couldn't run at Longchamp, you know. So a lot of his horses, and because of the COVID this year, you know, a lot of his horses are just where they'd be going over the edge now, tailing off. They're finding that they're getting their peak now. They're peaking. So, you know, I mean, the COVID sort of changed things a lot as far as the horses' form, because a lot of horses that would be over the top are now... you know, just getting good. I mean, I don't know how good this horse is, but obviously Aiden O'Brien saw something in him.
Well, the yesterday you heard Nick Luck too go over the pedigree Iridesa,
yeah.
and you know there was nothing but Starine. There was nothing but major pedigree to be associated with it.
We don't go by pedigree because all of Aiden O'Brien, all the Kuma horses are well bred.
True.
You know, if they're not by Galileo, they're by a son of Galileo, or the mare by Galileo. I mean, all their horses are well-bred. And they all got the Sadler's Wells, and they all got the Dane Hills, and the Galileos, and all, you know, all the big-name, all the usual suspects in the pedigrees. So, you know, I don't remember seeing a Coolmore horse by saying, oh, boy, where'd they come up with this pedigree? I mean, they're all well-bred. I think that's the main thing. The horse got lost. He got lost on the also eligible list, and he got lost with Aiden O'Brien having two other horses in there. And we thought the other horse was, Lope Fernandez. So we thought, wow, that's a stab. Who knew that there was another one that would be double his odds?
Exactly. Well, the long shot lad, Kev Humphreys, Nick Luck, Marcus Hirsch, all talked about Lope, every one of you. And so, I mean,
that's right there.
It was very funny. Well, he went from he ended up at 18-1, which actually feels like the right price on him now in retrospect.
Yeah, it
that feels like a square price.
At the time, the price was terrible. I mean, it was 30-1 in the morning line. I said 18-1. I said, must be everybody. Obviously, the word's been out on him, and then he went to finishing 30-1. I thought he was going to be the big, you know, Aiden O'Brien bomb. Who thought that he wouldn't even be close to being Aiden O'Brien's bomb?
No. I've got to watch this race again. Turf a little tougher to watch the turf from down there, but I do want to go back because Ivar. It looks like Ivar kind of ran evenly, but you know he only got beat a little under two lengths. Ended up fourth.
He's a good horse. I mean, I was actually surprised that they made him the morning line favorite. But, you know, listen, he did run well at Keeneland, and I liked his background. I like where he was coming from. I love those South American horses. He ran a big race, but I don't know that he should have been the favorite in there. It was a looked like a pretty wide open race.
Well, it was a wide open race, and I'm just looking. I didn't really realize this until now. When the gates opened, you had six horses. Six within $3 and change. Kamiko went off the favorite at just over 5-1. Uni,
right, which I can certainly see,
which is fine. Uni was second choice at 13-2, defending winner.
Yeah, it's like a European race.
Ivar was third choice at 7-1. Digital Age was fourth choice, 7.30-1. Factor This was the fifth choice at 7.60-1. And then Halliday, who ran fine, actually, was 9-1.
I thought it was going to be tough on the lead like that. I thought, you know, I said, you know, it's Pletcher. You know, horse has got a clear lead. I mean, he might get brave out on the lead like that. And he's got natural speed. I thought Halliday was going to be tough to catch in there.
They went fast, though. That race was run.
Yeah.
I mean, that was run in racehorse time. Although, interestingly, the late runners made no impact in this race. I guess the Uni and Lope were the horses that came from the furthest back to contend. Order of Australia was never further back than fourth. Circus Maximus was never further back than fifth. He was retired yesterday, by the way, I think I saw, right? Did I see that?
I think he retired. I mean, listen, if you were going to ask anybody who's, you know, which horse Aidan O'Brien was going to win that race with, you know, 19 out of 20 people would have said Circus Maximus.
No, and he ran better than I thought he would, actually. I was more interested in Lope than
him,
Circus.
You know, he was by far and away the best of Aidan O'Brien's horses.
I'll tell you who disappointed in there was Siskin. Siskin had plenty of attention.
Yeah, definitely.
And even Nick said yesterday that this was just not his bag, man. Who else? Digital had the bad start that doomed him. In fact,
not a great Breeders' Cup for Chad.
Yeah, Chad struggled, although, you know, Front Run the Fed ran very well his bad start. If he breaks like he's capable of, he would have impacted that turf sprint.
Who knows how Starchy Publey would have run? I mean, poor.
Ugh, that was awful.
Former claimer. You know, 7-year-old beats the boys in there, looking to go out, to throw a rider like that. I said,
felt awful.
Sometimes this game can be so cruel, you know. And then to watch Swiss Skydiver stumble, you know, when they first went off, I didn't realize it. And I watched the replay over again. I said, oh God, that was bad.
Yeah,
she obviously grabs herself pretty good because I saw the picture of her foot. She really, really did a number on it. She was was all raw back there, and I give her credit. You know, she made a big move when she was running like what was it next to last or two from back of the pack. I said, well, forget that. Something happened there, and then she made the big run along the rail. And I said, well, you know, she gets through, but you know, and if she came up empty, I said, all right, well, you know, she made a run. It wasn't a bad race at all. She made a. Then when I saw her foot that she was running with, I said, "Boy, she didn't." I mean, you hate to use the word. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood.
Of course, a million times.
Well, do you remember the scene? Do you remember the scene where he's got the shotgun pointed at Gene Hackman, and Gene Hackman says, "I was building a house. I don't deserve this."
Yeah.
And Clint Eastwood said, deserve. Got nothing to do with it.
That's right.
that's horse racing.
Yeah,
when you talk about
true.
The skydiver and you talk about Starship Jubilee, deserves got nothing to do with it. They're not in a race, not in a sport like horse racing.
No. I felt so bad for Kevin. He went out there
that was awful.
Shame.
I mean,
she's been retired, by the way, too.
Son, and it was, you know, his father handing the horse over to his son, and it's a great, great story. I mean, what a sad way to go out, you know, your last start.
Yeah. But she was retired, if people didn't see yesterday.
It's the Breeders' Cup. It's horse racing. And it can be cruel, sometimes very cruel, sometimes cruel in a more mundane way, but cruel enough anyway under the circumstances. But, hey, listen, the big thing is yet to come. Just be on the lookout later today. Just watch secretary.com. You're going to get the five finalists for the Vox Populi Award.
Oh, how
exciting. They'll be able to vote for their, forgetting about Horse of the Year and all the Eclipse Awards and like that. This is the real one, the most popular horse, the horse that's done the most for racing. And the five nominees are all good. You can make a case for any one of them.
Interesting.
So get
all
out
right.
there. Go on secretary.com or on their Facebook page or Instagram and vote. Vote for the most popular horse, not by what they did.
Hmm.
You know, it's over the course of the year, what they did for racing, how much of a following they had. Just look at some of the horses that have won this. Rapid Redux won. Winx won, who nobody in this country ever even saw. But,
yep.
You know, she had her popularity. She had people staying up until 1 o'clock in the morning to watch her race.
That's true.
So, you know, not just what you did on the racetrack. It's how popular you are, and it's gotten to be a big award. America's Best Racing is now heavily involved in it now, and it'll be interesting. So cast your vote.
I love it. Steve, well done and nice job. Sounds like you cashed a couple of tickets, and
better than nothing.
Exactly.
Sure.
It seems like that. I mean, I know some people have done. There's been some nice hits, and there were certainly there were nice opportunities. We'll get some more in tomorrow too. Some more of that kind of
analysis. Hey, listen, I got Joan high-fived me twice. That to me meant everything. I couldn't care about the money. The fact that Joan high-fived me twice. I just felt good. I said, I'm not a total idiot. You know, at least I'm still capable of picking a winner now and then. And I got good runs out of a couple of those long shots that we mentioned that finished in the money. So
exactly, exactly.
It was good. But that was the highlight. The high fives I got from Joan.
Nice. I love it, Steve. I appreciate it, and we'll see who your Vox Populi nominees are, and we'll talk next week.
All right, Steve. Take care.
Steve Haskin. And nice. Good for Steve. A couple of pops. That's all it takes. That's the beauty of this thing. And there's certainly, there were certainly some of those, some of the reverse tri-key types that you better believe it was certainly an opportunity. Fire Will, if you landed there, 30-1. VQuist was 660. Mother Earth, and that's how Kev Humphreys, his good opinion in the betting companion with Mother Earth at that price. It's funny. He did mention Miss Amulet, who was third, but he wanted her only if she was going to be a much bigger price. That's the way Kev, he structures the conversation. The horse that I should really get a hold of Doug O'Neill and get a little bit more about Hot Rod Charlie, 95-1. And, only got beat 3/4. By Essential Quality. I'm just noticing now the trifecta in the juvenile all had blinkers on. Essential Quality, Hot Rod Charlie, and Keep Me in Mind all had blinkers. And there was only one other horse, Classier, and that's that horse of Baffert's, the second time starter, and actually he split the field. He finished eighth. Those were the four horses with blinkers. Interesting. 26-1 for Wet Your Whistle. We've talked. If it wasn't for Eves's great ride, Trombetta wins the sprint and pays $55. That's notable. 62-1 for Jesus's team, and what a nice year Jose D'Angelo has crafted with him. That's a horse that has been kind of underappreciated. In a lot of ways, Adaria at 18-1 was, and Whitmore at 18-1. Those were both the best overlays. I mean, the Order of Australia was I mean, that was a tough one. Nobody's coming up with that. Dunbar Road, 26-1 third. There was no big prices in the turf, really, and Global Campaign and Tacitus, 25-21-1 in the Classic. Tony Black is standing by. I can hear him there. Tony, good morning.
Can you hear me breathing?
I can hear you breathing.
You know, the horse's name that really caught my attention was, because of the circumstances that existed at Parks, was You Better Believe It. There used to be an old guy at Parks that we all used to really kind of think a lot of, and we nicknamed him You Better Believe It. And because about the only thing he used to say to us when we would go by and say, hey, what's up, brother? You better believe it. And he's an old Cuban guy. He had to be 100 years old, and he's not there, of course, anymore. He's passed on. But we nicknamed him You Better Believe It, and that's all he used to say. That's the only English words, I think, that he might have known. And that horse's name caught my eye. But Parks, once again, we were represented pretty well by Butch Reed with V-Quest, and in the last couple of weeks, Parks has been represented pretty well with horses going to New York and winning 4 or 5 races, New York Breeders' Day, New York Breeds' Day, and going to Keeneland and winning one of the races, V-Quest winning from Butch Reed. So kind of still proud to be at Parks, even though at times I'm not so proud of the management at times, but I sure am proud of the horsemen and the horses and the jockeys and the trainers that come out of Parks. I'm sure proud of them.
Well, Butchie, we talked to, of course, on Monday, and that really was one of the real satisfying winners, and Moquette too on Monday. I mean, those were the two featured conversations that we had Monday for just the reasons you're outlining. This is the rank and file horseman out there getting to this opportunity, and you know, reaching the end.
You know, once again, listening to Steve Haskins, I totally agree with him when it comes to just about everything he says, and agree with him when it came to disappointment in the Classic.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still trying to scratch my head. What are you guys that are sitting on these horses, what are you thinking? They're going to run the race again so you can rectify your mistakes from the first time? They don't do that. You better do the right thing the first time. And Authentic, you know, he kind of redeemed himself. And even though when he got beat by Swiss Skydiver, he left the rail open, and that's why he got beat. Kind of halfway left the rail open in the Classic, but there wasn't enough horse to come running up the rail and give him any trouble. At the 3/16 pole, I thought maybe the rail horse would come running, but didn't, because he, you know, he had so much his way. Johnny just was, in the old terminology we used to use, what'd you guys do, put him on the lead? But, you know, it was a race that I scratched my head. I'm baffled. Now, I was listening to Al Foreman, and I usually agree a lot with him. But when it comes to this whip rule, and I don't know if you want me to get involved in this, but when it comes to this whip rule, he's given me the impression that this is some place they wanted to start, you know, putting these rules out there. But you know my saying, and what I think when it comes to whip rule, there is no blanket rule that fits every set of circumstances a jock is faced with when riding a racehorse. And if you have qualified people monitoring the race, they have the authority, and at their discretion, can pull a rider up at any time and tell him, listen, don't do that again. You abuse this horse, you're getting fined, you're getting suspended, or whatever. You know, you don't need a specific rule. You need people. You know, when it comes to being an official at most racetracks, they say you can be an official if you have administrative office experience, you know. Well, why don't they have a rule that says you can be an official, but you need hands-on experience with horses, with racehorses, either caring for them, handling them, and having some type of experience, hands-on experience with those horses. Then you can be an official. You need an administrative office experience, but you need hands-on experience with taking care of horses, riding horses, whatever, exercising, training, whatever. So some hands-on experience, but they don't do that. But they do say to people that do have hands-on experience with horses, oh, you can't be an official unless you have administrative office experience. So it's kind of backwards. If you had people sitting up there monitoring the races that knew exactly what a rider's doing on a horse's back, you don't need a special whip rule. You need qualified officials. That's what you need. But, you know, you get me going off on a tangent, Vic, and you pump me up listening to Al. And I know Al. He's, you know, he's a lawyer, and he's certainly a qualified opinion. Absolutely. And I guess the best I can say for his explanation of this is it was a starting point. Well, it's a starting point to nowhere. And when it came to the Guild getting involved with this, they're a day late and a dollar short. They should have been involved in this with crop rules when it first was implemented in California, when you have name riders and riders with prestigious performances and names behind their names, like Mike Smith, and said, listen, this is what we're going to do. You don't boycott races, that's for sure, because that's a stand against horse owners and trainers. What you do is you let the officials know, we see there's a rule, we're going to try to abide by it, but we're going to use our to the best of our knowledge, our riding experience, and we're not going to go and let this rule affect our performance. We're going to ride. If you see after the race that we infringed on the authority of this rule, fine, suspend, or do whatever you want. And we're going to appeal it. And you appeal the commission, the steward's decision if they do fine and suspend riders, appeal it. When it goes to the commission, if the commission doesn't agree that you rode your horse to the best of your ability to get the most forward position to accommodate the betting public and the horse owner, if they don't agree that's what you did, then you appeal their decision. Then if the guild wants to get involved, they should say, we're going to get involved and represent you guys legally in a Commonwealth court. And you go to a court of law and you explain it to a judge what you did. I rode to the best of my ability to get the most forward position with this horse in order to accommodate the owner and the betting public. Let the commission go and tell what their credentials are in making these rules, and let them go and tell a judge that, well, he might have got the most forward position for the public and the owner, but he infringed on the authority of this rule, and he hit him 7 times, or he cocked his stick instead of hitting him underhanded, or he hit him 10 times. But he did use it in a way that was humane, and it was used in a way that got his horse the most earning capability that he could get his horse, the most forward position. But go to court and let the commission and these people that make these rules explain to everybody what this rule means and why you are penalizing a jock for doing his best. You used to penalize jocks because they didn't do their best. Now you're penalizing them because they're doing their best. And you know what? If these rules get into place, and I told some riders, but, you know, I'm not an effective or representative anymore. Just go out there and ride to the best of your ability. Never abuse a horse, but use the stick in a way that gets your horse its most forward position. That's what you do on horses' backs. You don't follow some blanket rule that doesn't fit every set of circumstances that a jock is faced with while riding a racehorse. Now, does that explain my position, Vic?
Of course. And you know, it's actually the way you phrase that and couch it, that really fits a lot of the elements of the entire sport and the industry, and actually it's kind of an interesting corollary to the conversation we had with Alan Foreman. And it really ties into what I was trying to bring up with him, which is the challenge of changing with the demands of societal and cultural shifts. And I mean, when it comes to the stick, it's one of these perception things. And, you know, people think that any encouragement with an implement is us abusing the animals. And of course, you know, the stick that's being used now compared to what Snapper Garrison used.
No comparison.
It's crazy. But you know, even if you, I don't know. Maybe have Ramon Dominguez ask Ramon. Can we get a few thousand of these and mail them to these critics and let them see a foam core stick and what it is and realize, this is just a way to kind of like prod them along. You're not abusing them.
The challenge
continues to be how to educate and enlighten critics. But the problem is, I don't sense that the people that you're trying to appease have any interest. It's a group that's got minds made up, and plus the problem is they're also being influenced by documentation. In some case, they're just running the same videos and using the same graphic material that isn't a fair representation. I mean, all you got to do is look at the numbers that Alan presented yesterday and see. I mean, you've had fatalities cut in half in 10 years, and it's a constant the constant effort. Now, some people will say, well, that's still too many, and that means that there's no good reason to do this. I'll reiterate that the good reason to do this is because it employs and sustains a million people's lives and families. There's a business attached here. We're not doing this like a sideshow.
I don't feel, let's say, they might advertise against certain industries that they don't like, but they don't say put them out of business. You don't like the tobacco industry, but they still sell cigarettes. You know why? Because it employs millions and millions of people. It's a big industry. It creates employment. It creates revenue. Don't they tax you on your cigarettes? But I don't see anybody saying other than advertise against it. Yeah, that's fine. But nobody's banned it where they've shut these companies down. Don't shut horse racing down because you don't you are not a fan and think it's inhumane.
What about alcohol?
Almost ruined my life. Yeah, what about alcohol? Smoking, you're drinking. And maybe I didn't smoke, but I did a lot of drinking. They didn't shut down the Bud Miller brewery. And I think it was mostly Miller. It wasn't Bud, it was Miller. Hey, why didn't they shut that industry down? Maybe I wouldn't have been such an alcoholic in that 8 or 9 year period. Yeah, but you're a good example, smoking, drinking, and that. And when it comes to horse racing, like you said, it's a viable, thriving industry. I don't see them people gamble on these horses. Well, I don't see them shutting down casinos. People gamble at casinos.
Shutting down. Shutting down.
Opening them up. We got a new one opening up in Philly.
There's one on every street corner.
Yeah. But, the thing about it that really irks me, in the attempt to change people's perception of the sport, you are actually hurting the fans and the people who already embrace the sport. Let's not step on their toes and say, well, you don't count. We got to change this this public opinion of the sport. The people, you're never going to get these people to be your fans of horse racing. They've got a predetermined mindset that horse racing is inhumane. And when it comes to this, you want to monitor the sticks that are used. Yeah, I'm all for that. This Ramon Dominguez soft touch crop is unbelievable. Steve, I could hit you with it. It would make a lot of noise. It wouldn't leave a mark on you. And you would look at me and say, well, when are you going to hit me? The one thing that it does get a response with horses is it's the sudden movement of your hands, the sudden movement of the stick and them catching it with the peripheral vision. The sudden movement and sound that it makes, that's what horses respond to. It's like more of a threat than an abusive action that you're taking on these horses' backs. It really irks me what they're doing with these whip rules. And, you get me started on that, and I agree with a lot of what people say, and I understand where Al Foreman was coming from. But you know what? You don't need whip rules. You need qualified people monitoring the performance of jockeys' use and abuse of a stick. And that's Yeah, you there?
Yeah, I'm there. That's great. I think that this discussion.
I thought it through pretty good.
Yeah,
absolutely. I got a lot of time on my hands. If I'm not listening to you on the radio and listening to the great job you do, and Steve Haskin and some of your speakers, if I'm not listening to them, I'm sitting home doing a lot of thinking. And even when I'm on backs in the morning, I got on 15 horses in the last 3 days. I worked 1/5 of a mile the other day. Worked real good. Second horse I worked in a year, and Milton the Monster worked like a champ. But if I'm even when I'm on these horses' backs, sitting and thinking about what I'm going to say on Steve Bick's broadcast. Because That's how much respect I have for you.
Nice.
And of course, I always agree with Haskin because he acts like and talks as if he sat on horses' backs. So maybe he has a jockey in another lifetime. I'm not sure.
When it came to on the jockey front, we just got a couple of minutes to close out, so we'll stay with it. It really turned out that the interesting storylines came on the riding side, Tony, came from these lesser-known European riders. This Tom Eaves and Colin Keane and Pierre Boudot. These are not, if you follow international, you see them ride. Ended up being a real showcase for them. And that's fun. That's one of the things that kind of adds to the appeal. The international quality when it comes to guys like Dermot Weld and O'Brien and even James Fanshawe, who won, etc., Kevin Ryan. Sometimes you're finding out about people you didn't know. But the riders to me were as entertaining a set of storylines this weekend as we had.
Absolutely. And you know what? They have a different purchase when they're sitting on a horse. And it stands out, like, to the American rider, how different we look. But it's as effective as what we do. We just learn a different style than they learn. They have a different style when it comes to the length of iron that they ride, when it comes to how they move their upper body and lower body, which is their ass and legs, and their hands. And they really, that style is different, but very effective, as it showed in the Breeders' Cup performances. At one point when I was a kid, I used to look at the European rider and say, Jesus Christ, he looks like a wind sail. Or, geez, what's he, he's moving so much. But, horses respond to body movement. They change leads according to your body movement on their back. And the American rider has gotten away the way where he sits, maybe a little firmer looking, but he has to learn how to use his weight as he becomes a more accomplished rider to the advantage of the horse. Like when it comes to going into a turn, you want him to change to his left lead, you don't just pull on the left rein and pull him around the turn. You take your right foot in the iron and kind of sway it out, and then you sway your body back in and you pop him over. When you come to that lane, you want him to change leads, you use your body weight. And it's a learned process. And the European riders have it, I guess, from day one. They use their body weight in the most efficient and effective way. At times you'll see their asses kind of come back on a horse's ass. And it reminds me of some of the old riders I rode with that kind of saw that bouncing movement on a horse. And one of them in particular, which you can't in any way criticize his riding style, Bill Hardtack. I rode a lot at the end of his career with him. And he had an in-between American rider and European riding style. And I used to say, man, that horse's kidneys must really hurt when you get off his back. But no, it didn't. He got a lot of run out of horses. I mean, he won 5 Preaknesses, didn't he? I think four or five.
That's
he won
right.
every. Yeah, I mean, the guy was a phenomenon. But I really appreciate watching the European and the American riders and comparing them, and they both are effective and efficient in their styles.
And I'm glad we went in this direction, too, because it's something we haven't talked about in years, because, you know, we used to watch those, you see those guys flailing, and they don't seem, it seems like they've reined themselves in somewhat. They're not as, as armsy and shouldery as they used to be, because
right.
to me, it always seemed, and I asked you about this years ago, that it seemed like you were taking the balance and the harmony, away from the horse. That it had to be a methodology that was counterproductive. It seemed to me. And then you addressed that. We'll revisit that, Tony, because we got to pull up and say goodbye.
Always a pleasure, and keep up the good work. And thanks for having me, Steve. I really appreciate
Tony. I love it.
Beginning.
I'll talk to you next week, Tony
love
Black.
You,
everybody, thank you. I love it. Tony Black, everybody, and Steve Haskett and Alan Foreman, Nick Tamaro, and I'll get the cross-country pick five play up on the website. Give me about an hour. Got to eat a little something. Haven't eaten. And grilled the other night. I grilled some burgers, so I've got to put like five of them away. It's like, like a squirrel. And Dick Powell as well. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Indiana wraps up their week today. And we wrap up our week tomorrow. Week has flown by, and I still haven't done everything. Together tomorrow, weekend preview, weekend wrap-up, Jay Pridman, Marty McGee, and more. Nick, I'm hoping to get, we need a Paul, we got to have Paul Matisse do his Breeders' Cup postmortems. We always do that with Paul. What the best opportunities were, and so forth, in retrospect. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. Website later for some archive and pod and everything else. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire all-star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.